Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book about some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. My guest this week is David Snowden. We are discussing his book, Riding the Prize Fight, Pierce Egan's Boxiana World, published in 2013 by Peter Long. As David explains at the start of the interview, he is a literary scholar, and his book examines the themes and style of Pierce Egan's writing on English prize fighting, which was published in the early 1800s in multiple volumes titled Boxiana. The book also presents a detailed and colorful view of the early history of boxing and sports writing. And David earned last year's Lord Aberdare Literary Prize for his contribution to the scholarship on British sports history. In our interview, David tells us of the broad community of fighters, patrons, gamblers, and boxing enthusiasts who together made up what was called the Fancy in early 19th century England. He discusses what made Pierce Egan's writing distinctive and how Egan influenced later writers of the 1800s, including Charles Dickens. David also comments on the lasting influence of Egan's work, which we read and hear today in contemporary sports commentary. Here's my interview with David Snowden. My guest for this episode of New Books in Sports is David Snowden on the line from Sunderland. David, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you very much.
So we typically start each episode of the podcast with a bit of background about the author. So would you please tell us something about yourself and how you developed your interest in the boxing culture of early 19th century Britain?
Yeah, sure. I went into academic life relatively late. I used to work for a bank, and actually I was in my 30s. I decided to go into full-time education, did an English literature degree at my local university, which is Sunderland, University of Sunderland. And I enjoyed that and decided I was going to stay on and do a master's. And at the time I was looking to move from my dissertation at undergraduate level had been on Dr. Samuel Johnson and his periodical essays. So I was searching around during the summer between doing my degree and my master's to a new subject area. And some of my summer reading, I latched on to in an anthology on 19th century literature or romantic literature. On Pierce Egan, there was a couple of illustrations from his life in London, which is his 1821 Metropolitan work, and it looked a rather interesting topic. I managed to obtain the book via interlibrary loans, had a read of it. Wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be. I imagined in my mind that it was going to be a cross between the Dickens Pickwick Papers and perhaps George MacDonald Fraser's Flashman novels. So it wasn't exactly what I'd expected. However, I recognised it as a rich source of material to do a master's dissertation on. So that went fine. And so next stage, obviously, was I was going to stay in education to do my doctorate, my PhD, and I moved to the University of Newcastle to do that, but we're still in the northeast of England. And again, I was searching about, I've done Samuel Johnson, I've done Pierce Egan, shall I look for something new? But one of my professors at Sunderland, although I didn't end up doing my PhD there, suggested, well, you've looked at Pierce Egan's Metropolitan writing and you've done a lot of research, got a lot of research under your belt. Why don't you look at his sporting literature, in particular his pugilistic writing? And this seemed a logical a good piece of advice. So I drafted my proposal to various institutions based on those lines to look at PSA and pugilistic writing with the benefit, the added benefit that I already had a great deal of relevant research in the locker, so to speak, that was going to come into play for my in-depth research into P.S. Sagan's life in London. So I did my PhD in Newcastle, and I completed that in, it was actually 2008.
Mm-hmm. So is there a lot of scholarly literature, or any scholarly literature, on P.S. Sagan in terms of the looking at him in the landscape of early 19th century British writing?
No, and this is one of the, arguably one of the attractions of going into an area which hasn't been not the well-worn path. I could have considered the likes of Charles Dickens or Virginia Woolf, which were very admirable topics or subject areas to go into, but they seem as if they've been covered from most angles imaginable. And so venturing with P.S. Sagan, it was a case of this was, generally speaking, something new. There were articles, there were essays in scholarly journals, the occasional one, but the only real sustained piece of writing, a book devoted to P.S. Sagan, was the 1971 work by John C. Reed, which was called Books and Bruises, and that was a very broad study of Egan. It was more of a biography, and it covered a lot of ground where his Boxiana writings only perhaps a couple of chapters worth, and a very good book, but it's the only one to my knowledge that existed of P.S. Sagan, and therein only a couple of chapters specifically devoted to his sports writing or his pugilistic writing.
Mm-hmm. So your professor had suggested that you look at his boxing writing. Did you have an interest in boxing before that?
No, I didn't. And again, even up to the present day, I do have some general knowledge about boxing or sport in general, many sports from my younger days, and I would say I have a lot of in-depth. I'll be very good at quizzes on the 1970s and 1980s sports, but I wasn't interested particularly in boxing. I could name a few significant boxing and boxers from the 70s and 80s, sure, and of course what academics, if I'm coming at it from more of from an academic angle, one could argue that what I'm looking at, bare knuckle prize fighting, is so far removed from the modern day boxing world of gloved fighters and generally speaking 12 or 15 3-minute rounds, that it certainly wasn't a prerequisite to be interested in boxing, because I feel as if there's that obvious connection between boxing and the bare knuckle and its forerunner, the bare knuckle prize fighting, an obvious connection. But in the same breath, they're almost two separate worlds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, so we'll turn to the book and we'll discuss Egan's writing, but first you should tell us about the context of The Fancy. So what was The Fancy?
Yes, The Fancy, generally with a capital F, would be it was mainly in the Regency, which is early 19th century Britain. You're talking about approximate dates. I mean, the official regencies, I think, is 1810 to 1821, when the Prince Regent took the throne. But it's generally covers a broader period in that first half of the 19th century. Yes, The Fancy was applied to people who were interested in sport, who followed the sporting events, but it was particularly applied to the world of prize fighting, the prize fighting followers, also the the typical characters who were described in Egan's Metropolitan work about life in London were these men about town, the sporting books. There were, I would say to be a member of the fancy, it could be a cross class, a cross more of a catch-all term, but I think was particularly applicable to this a certain class of sporting gent.
Mm-hmm. And so this was something that involved both upper classes as well as lower classes.
Very much. It was there was a heterogeneous mix of characters. Even the sport itself was supposed to permit or allow for inter-class bouts, a member of the upper class could step into the prize fight arena with a member of the lower classes. But that was in theory. I think in reality, that class, the actual fighting, the fighters themselves, the upper classes restricted themselves to being patrons or doing the publicity, really, I suppose you could argue that carried on into the 20th century. They made the money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And was this a period when prize fighting was illegal or legal? What was its status?
It was illegal. Ironically, things like cockfighting was still legal. I think when prize fighting had been made illegal, cockfighting became illegal in 1849, but it was many decades before then where the prize fighting was susceptible to be clamped down on with regard to laws against affray and breaches of the peace. So there was very much a clandestine arrangement regarding prize fights being arranged, that it would be very much word of mouth, and the fancy, mm-hmm. Or the pugilistic club would try and select venues, open-air venues, these were generally, that were very close to county borders, so that if they were stopped late on in proceedings before the fight commenced in one county, the whole entourage would traipse maybe 4 or 5 miles across the county border and try to look in the next county. So it was technically illegal, but again, especially for the big prize fights, sometimes a blind eye was turned, and especially when some competition would emerge between various towns to have the fight take place on or around their vicinity, because it was recognised that it was an economically profitable thing to happen, especially for the local taverns and shopkeepers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this was something. So even though Piers Egan was based in London as a writer, the fights that he was watching, the matches, would take place in the countryside surrounding the city then.
Yeah, and places like, for London, Wimbledon Common used to be used, for example. Usually they were quite a hardy bunch, the fancy, and they would traipse around the countryside for quite a number of miles, especially if the attraction was there for a major fight, which had excited the imagination. There were other pugilistic hotbeds in England. Bristol was a very well-known place for producing boxers, but to have the fights reported with any great regularity, an ambitious prize fighter would have to eventually gravitate towards the London. Mm-hmm. In an area to raise his profile.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what types of crowd, what kinds of crowds are the size are we talking about? So these are in the thousands, correct?
I would say for the big fights, the smaller affairs or the impromptu affairs would certainly be not thousands.
Okay.
This is the thing where it's difficult to gauge the smaller scale affairs very much, I think, relied on the likes of PSE and to generate the publicity and the interest, because not every fight was on the scale of Cribb v. Molyneux or a Jem Belcher versus Hen Pierce, or even going back into the 1820s, the subject of William Hazlitt's quite famous essay, The Fight, or the fight between Bill Neat and Tom Hickman, known as the Gas Man. These fights were in the minority. Okay. So they could generate these big attendances that you mentioned, but on the smaller scale, certainly not those numbers. And then you had to rely on the imaginative and idiosyncratic, almost reporting style of Piers Egan to generate the interest.
Okay, so Egan then performed a function for members of the fancy in London who were unable to travel out into the countryside to see the matches.
Certainly, and I think as time goes on and you go into the 1830s, prize fighting was on the wane, mm-hmm. and there's some of the descriptions where you can imagine a person who was keen to witness the fight. It got to a stage where you had to be quite a diehard follower of the prize fighting world to get up in the early hours of the morning to undertake possibly quite a lengthy trek. There was obviously the outlay of money you would have to pull out perhaps for food, or perhaps even overnight accommodation. And there's an argument to be made that to go that far and then to end up in a rather what could be a very brutish, unmannerly crowd for a long distance view of the fight, well to the back, that it would be it would probably get to a stage where you would think twice about venturing out, and to have the boxing, the prize fight reports in a convenient form and delivered in an entertaining style, it would be, there's a point to be made that it would be a preferable thing to be sitting in one by one's fireside reading the reports rather than getting out in the elements for a restricted view.
So the same question that we have today, is it better to watch a match on our flat screen, high definition televisions, or go with the crowds and deal with the elements and the high cost of food and so forth at the stadium?
Yeah, I think what doesn't transfer to the modern era is, or always is not an issue in the modern era, is that gambling, the gambling element was such a major part of the perhaps the attraction of being present in the 19th century, whereas that isn't, obviously that's not an obstacle, as one could have access to online, and well, I'm not really into gambling, but I'm aware that it's very, you could be watching, as you say, your big screen TV and still be able to, if gambling was your thing, you could gamble to your heart's content, whereas perhaps people who wanted to get out and meet their friends and socialise and drink and indulge in this really heavy gaming aspect, which was part of the part and parcel of the fancy and such a preoccupation. I think sometimes when they spoke, there's some snatches of dialogue where people are if they're speaking, hardly a sentence goes by without some gambling reference. Mm-hmm. So I think that was certainly an attraction that would, if you were really keen on the gambling aspect, that would keep you going to the fights.
Mm-hmm. So we have these upper-class spectators and gamblers and patrons of the fights and lower-class boxers. What benefits did the boxers gain from being part of this?
I think there was a reciprocal arrangement, whereas the upper-class patron would get some reflected glory from hanging out, so to speak, with the lower class man who he wouldn't normally wish to be socialised with, but because he's a famous pugilist, then the upper class patron gets this reflected glory of socialising with this revered prize fighter. The prize fighter will have more money at his disposal, he will dress fashionably, eat well, and obviously it's in the his patron's interest to make sure that he's well fed and he's fit to fight and he's strong. I think that sometimes I get an inkling with Piers Egan that one or two fight lower class prize fighters, they sometimes stepped over a line where they got a little too used to socialising in the upper class circles, and they temporarily forgot that they couldn't just swing by to the mansion or the upper class dwelling uninvited. They weren't. There's a question of whether they were tolerated. There's a couple of examples given. I think that Egan mentioned specifically, he makes specific grants to mention that prize fighter's downfall has been expedited by the fact that he got his head was turned by the grand lifestyle, and they imagine that they're part and parcel of that scene, but when their use has run its limit, run its course to the upper class patron, the patron, if he was a ruthless man, could just cut them off, and that exacerbated their downfall on some occasions.
So let's add in another element to the fancy, and that is the writing. And something you explained at the start of the book is that Piers Egan was not alone in writing about boxing at the time. So can you talk about the broader environment of early sports writing?
Well, I think the big fights between Tom Cribb and Tom Molyneux, the original match and then the rematch in 1810 and 11, it seems as if one or two publications latched onto that as the publicity as a starting point to issue a volume. Pancratia or Pancratia, I'm never sure exactly how people would pronounce that, but that was produced in 1812, but that was anonymous. You've got Bell's Life in London, their editor, Vincent Dowling. Egan's great rival was John B. That's J-O-N, John B, which was the pseudonym of John Badcock, who was very much he's arguably on a par with Egan because he took over the editorship of Boxiana 4. And if you're reading Boxiana 1, 2, 3, and then you go to Boxiana 4, it's almost a seamless transition. But you had the Sporting magazine, which I believe saw light of day in 1792 for the first time. And again, it set out its stall pretty early on that it was going to provide details of the fights to satisfy people's thirst for the gaming, because more gambling led to greater toleration of the prize fight activity itself. So we had the Sporting magazine. I think Bell's Life in London, which was at its zenith in the round about the same period as Boxiana in the in the 1830. Robert Surtees came along and he banned it from his sporting magazine. But by this time we're into 1831. So it had that, Boxiana had that golden period. And we had Vincent Dowling, John B, but by the time there was a change of culture as we go into the Victorian period. Bank holidays were greatly reduced. Leisure time was frowned upon. A sport that had been tolerated when it was deemed to be useful in some way, when the Napoleonic Wars were on, it ceased to be winked at, and it was on the decline. And on one or two publications, started to disappear from the columns, such as the Sporting Magazine.
Well, so let's talk about what set Egan and Boxiana apart, and I'll ask you first to give an introduction of him. So, who was he? Who was Piers Egan? Where was he from, and how did he come to be part of the fancy?
Right. Well, he was again. John Reed has done some very much in-depth research and has been over to Ireland, and he tried to get to the bottom of where Piers Egan was born, and he couldn't really nail it down with any degree of certainty. So there is a possibility that Egan was born in Ireland, but what is certain is that by the time he was a toddler, probably age two or three, he was in London. His mother and father were certainly from Ireland. They came over. His father was working in London, and we see Piers Egan being brought up in the metropolis. I think he was quite in a district where it was near to the world of the theatre, and this was a big influence on Egan. And he's got into the world of the fancy via the drinking clubs, probably the theatrical circles, and it's very much the underworld of literature before he breaks into the sporting journalism, because he gains experience in the printing trade. Mm-hmm. And I think this is evident sometimes when you're reading Boxiana, the typographical use of the variation Egan uses. There's block capitals, there's small capitals, italics. And you think his experience in the printing trade is coming to the fore there.
So, of course, a large part of Egan's writing with Boxiana is devoted to the fights themselves, but he also presented a much broader view of the fancy, and I want to ask in particular about the boxers. How did he present the boxers in his writing?
Yes, very much in elevated terms, using metaphors or analogies that would liken them to classical heroes, to military figures. Obviously, the Napoleonic Wars were raging at the time, references to Napoleon and Wellington. I think he was a well-educated man, and he would use, as I said, the classical references. And he certainly, there was no condescension from Piers Egan. He would treat these men who were coal heavers and butchers and costermongers. He would speak of them in elevated terms, and it was almost as if he, in the pages of Boxiana, and when these men took into the, they might have their travails and their troubles in everyday life about work and money and family and health, but when they entered the prize ring, it was almost as if they were they were playing a part, and the eyes of the world were on them, and I suppose to an extent via Piers Egan's publicity of them, to the eyes of the sporting world, at least the eyes were very much on them. Mm.
And yet at the same time, he presented boxers as akin to classical heroes, but an important element of his writing that you talk about is his use of slang. And he did this in a creative and also a careful way. Can you talk about how he used slang in his writing?
I think if one reads through the volumes of Boxiana, you can see a progression in the sophistication of the use of slang. You could go from very very simplistic slang, which could be, I mean, you could have a person's eye referred to as an ogle. So you could have Egan using the term for a blow to that part of the body, and all he does is he adds the letter R or the letter ER to an existing slang word for a body part to denote a blow to that part of the body. Well, now that's very basic, that's a very elementary approach, but you see it as the volumes go on, that he sometimes, there's evidence, well, I believe I've find one or two instances where Egan will actually arguably coin a new expression, coin a new slang word. Or if he doesn't use a slang term, he can use just an imaginative turn of phrase to transform the mundane, the banal, into something more mysterious. For example, the people being caught in a terrible shower of rain, he describes them as being drippingly assailed, as opposed to were drenched or soaked to the skin. Or if somebody received a blow to the head, he might say something like, "Oh, that set the botherums on duty in the brain country," which is quite long-winded, but I think that can be excused because it makes it a more interesting read.
Mm-hmm. So are there words or phrases that in Egan's writing that had lasting use in English?
Well, in my book I do have a slang glossary in the closing pages, which is which has been complimented on, I'm pleased to say, as one or two critics have remarked that they wish they'd had this at their disposal when they were doing their own research into an article onto this period. I'm not sure that Egan, I think in the Oxford English Dictionary there are one or two instances where the first citation of a word or expression is cited, and Boxiana is cited as the first known use. They're not very many. I'm a supporter of Egan, but I wouldn't go overboard with my claims for the. Certainly, he coined a few expressions, but when I say, perhaps that's misleading to say he coined them, because some of these were once only expressions.
Uh-huh. Well, related to that, you do write about in your book about Egan's influence on later 19th century writers and including Dickens. And so, can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is very much a hotly debated point. Not specifically with Piers Egan, but there's a lot of ongoing research, even books that have been produced this year about Egan. I don't know if it's putting it too strongly, but Egan's. I meant to say Charles Dickens's plagiarism. people are arguing that he's stolen And I don't think I'm putting it too strongly to say that they are accusing Dickens of stealing ideas and then passing them off as his own. Now I'm not saying he's done that with Piers Egan. If I read a work by Charles Dickens and I stand this side by side with a work by Piers Egan, okay, I'm an advocate for Piers Egan, but I will fully concede that the superior writing is very much with Charles Dickens. Having said that, Dickens, once he was established, seems to have been very swift to try and quieten down any reference to the influence that Piers Egan's life in London had on him, because there are obvious links, I think, to be made with a trio of protagonists wandering the metropolis, having sprees and adventures, as Piers Egan does in Life in London, and then for Charles Dickens to produce approximately 15 years later, The Pickwick Papers. The Pickwick Papers is a superior piece of writing, but there does seem to be a link, and for Dickens to totally disown or to almost banish reference to Piers Egan and to Life in London seems very harsh. On the reverse side of the coin, I think Piers Egan's own work in 1838, Pilgrims of the Thames in Search of the National, that could be said that it was... it could be argued that that was influenced by Dickens's Pickwick Papers, and certainly one or two of the illustrations has a rotund Pickwick figure in the foreground. But Dickens does make references in one or two of his novels to pugilists, or he uses boxing expressions in Little Dorrit. He uses boxing expression in Martin Chuzzlewit, and also in very early on in Hard Times. There's a major reference to the prize fighting world, and later on he talks about somebody frightened that somebody's going to come round and challenge them to a tussle in Lancashire fashion, which was a rough form of prize fighting. So there's quite a few pugilistic references that Charles Dickens uses, and the more obvious link is with his Metropolitan work. I'm going to not be too decisive on that point. I think that it can be argued that Dickens did use Egan's work as an influence. But I'm not going to... I don't argue too strongly because the quality of Dickens' writing is superior to Egan's.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you do see as well, and you talk about this in the book, some distant echoes of Egan's style of writing in contemporary sports writing.
Yes, I do. I think the temptation when looking at the array of reports and also I've got to be the temptation to go into a different broadcast medium where I cease to look at the written word so I'm a bit wary about dwelling too long on radio, the spoken word, or TV broadcasts, because draw a few parallels, certainly, but it's obviously a different medium, but boxing writing, the work of Norman Mailer when he's writing about Muhammad Ali, A.J. Liebling, the 20th century, I think he wrote for the New Yorker, And he makes specific reference that he was a fan of Piers Egan. So there's quite a few boxing where you can draw a line between or a, from Piers Egan's 19th century works through to the 20th century in Liebling, and Liebling says that as Egan might have termed it, and then again, I'm it's easy to cherry pick. Mm-hmm. Because one can go through and cherry pick the prime examples or the amusing takes where you could say, well, this in its, whilst you can't directly relate it to Piers Egan's Boxiana writing, what I sometimes say is I think it's very much in the Egan-esque spirit, mm-hmm. where it's trying to elevate the mundane. It's trying to breach that discrepancy between promise and reality, the often slick build-up to a sporting event, this anticipation. And then one seated in front of your big-screen TV, the floodlights are on, the gladiators or the sportsmen take the arena, and the actual sporting event starts. And it is drab, and it is boring, and it is an anticlimax, and all the time, obviously. But this is where this imaginative creativity of the sports broadcaster, or as I'll prefer to the sports writer, this is where they've sometimes a bit of if you approve of artistic license, and I think it's probably clear from my book that I do approve of it. I think there's times where remaining too faithful to the facts is just too tedious. Mm-hmm. And you've got to breathe some life into the reporting and make a little give the reporter a little bit of creative leeway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As I was reading the book, I enjoyed your comment right there. I was trying to think of a contemporary, current day analogy to Egan. And so in this day of blog writing, we do seemingly have a similar situation to Egan's time in terms of the wealth of writing that's available. And I was trying to think of anybody. Do you have ideas of anyone who has the same approach as Egan in terms of the amount of writing, the quality of writing, and also the inventiveness that Egan had?
I think there is either a greater array of inventive, ingenious writers around now, or they have more license allowed to express themselves, where in 19th century terms it was more straight-laced, and the word maverick reporter is now devalued.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it has become devalued. There's an overabundance of writers or even if you go into the sporting arena, perhaps sportsmen who are either self-styled or are styled by the pundits as being entertainers or mavericks, and I think that the word is bandied about a little too much. But there's certainly a lot of it. I say a lot of inventive reporting out there. And in fact, If I was going to try and pick parallels now with Egan, there would be an overabundance there. It would become almost a pointless exercise. Egan was more of a, in his period, and even arguably into the first half of the 20th century, he was more of a rarity. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't stand out now. Mm. But even in today's world, There's things that make me sit up. I think it was the NFL season, not last season, the season before, where the British coverage, which is only a 1 hour's highlight program, it was watching a New England Patriots game. It was the last seconds. The crowd was screaming. They'd given up on their team. And I think Tom Brady, the quarterback, throws a tremendous pass, which is caught in the end zone by one of the receivers. And the reporter, just the broadcaster, just goes, got off on a tangent where he starts saying about something like unicorns, show ponies, where's the beef? And it was just almost a surreal piece of sporting commentary. and the references to an old TV commercial, but I don't think that's the point. I hadn't heard of this TV commercial. You don't get it in Britain, or you didn't get it in Britain. Where's the beef? But I knew instinctively where the report. The fact that he was making cultural references to things I'd never heard of before, didn't know about, it didn't really matter. I knew what he meant. It was in that, what I would say, that flamboyant spirit, and he conveyed exactly what I knew what he was conveying. But he even though the cultural references, I wasn't specifically sure of them.
Well, David, we're almost out of time, and so to finish up, I'll ask you. So, what are you working on now?
Well, I've just had an article published for to do with the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo, where I'm linking. It's the Historian magazine, so that was I was linking the prize fighting mentality of a British nation and the manliness, the hardihood it was supposed to breed in its population in general. I was linking that with the 200th anniversary. I entitled the piece "Waterloo's Prize Fight Factor," so that's just being published.
So that topic of fighting and masculinity and English nationalism during the Napoleonic era, I completely forgot to ask about that. But this is really a key theme of the fancy as well as Egan's writing.
Oh, yes, very, very much so. In fact, one of my chapters in the book is devotes a great deal of space to the question that if we don't even have to look at the pugilists themselves. If we look at the people who followed them, the stamina that sometimes they've got to, the endurance that they've got to exhibit to just to get to the fight at times, and the traipsing around the countryside, and then when the fights themselves take place, it fended off what he perceived as, or the nation perceived as this emasculation, which was viewed on as a foreign effeminacy. It's a phrase, French effeminacy is a phrase that crops up quite a bit in the Boxiana writings, and it said this, the fortitude and the hardihood and this stamina, pluck, whichever adjective you want to apply to it, the world of prize fighting, and this built up, and it became inherent in the British nation.
You've been listening to an interview with David Snowden about his book, Writing the Prize Fight, Pierce Egan's Boxiana World, published in 2013 by Peter Long. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, biography, popular music, and more. Go to newbooksnetwork.com to find the subjects you're interested in. And if you like what you heard here, please follow us on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.